Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60, and I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this terribly named podcast series. But the QA, that's the important part. As we sort out our microphone and technical difficulties, this entire stream melting down around us. But we're going to get through this show because we've got some fun stuff to talk about. Last week was a really sciencey show. It was really news heavy. This week, we've got some things that I've had under embargo we can finally talk about. And we've got the reveal just this morning, hitting all the news feeds, the reveal on the new Xiaomi foldable. So that's really going to, I think that's a really exciting new development in smartphone releases this year. And I've got an amazing crew helping me tune my microphone. It's like every week, StreamYard and Restream. I don't know what's going on. You know what I think part of the problem is that I do one show on Restream and one show on StreamYard, and switching back and forth, what I put into each service is not what you hear. And I think changing from service to service is, like, it's a bigger difference between Restream and StreamYard. So I might just need to, like, pick one and just stick with that. We'll have to see. I like Restream. TK likes StreamYard. So we're going to have to, like, duke it out. Maybe have, like, some kind of celebrity boxing match, only for not celebrities. Like, we're Y-list celebrities. So there you go. Yeah, really, really stoked to see such a fine crew in here. I'm seeing Lamprose, JMX, Dave Byrne, Simon Says Hypno, ER1980, Gormlord, Barry, who am I missing? Coppa Cash, Brian Billing, Ownscon, I said Dave, McCorkerin. Oh, McCorkerin gets while we were in the lead up to the pre-show, subscribed again on Twitch. So you get a because I don't have any kind of fancy soundboard. Ron Guido. I think I missed some other people. Oh, and Scoop. Bionic Scoop. So we've got a great show going. Malik. Hey, what's up? Hey, folks. I hope everybody had a lovely weekend. I went out with the fam. This is kind of like one of the first, like, big family movie excursions that we've had all together. It's just been weird. Like, Marie and Lex have gone to a few movies. Marie and I have gone to a few movies. Like, we actually haven't done, like, mom, dad, and daughter go to the movies in a little while. And we went to go see Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Mutant Mayhem. And as someone who grew up with the original Eastman and Laird comics, to the point where I actually didn't love the animated series that they made for kids in the 90s, just because the Eastman and Laird comics were really dark and grimy and edgy and kind of hyper-violent. I was probably reading them too young. What would have that been for me? I think I started reading TMNT in mid-school. So yeah, like fourth or fifth grade. Anyway, Mutant Mayhem is a really fun, complete story reboot. I don't want to spoil it because I feel like involved in the mythos of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, there have been commonalities, no matter how you reboot the series, that some things have always just sort of stayed the same. I really like how this movie lets go of some of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle tropes. This was such a sweet movie to share with my daughter. She's 7, and she said some of the action scenes were a little scary and a little intense. But overall, she really liked the movie. She was sitting there eating some popcorn, really getting into it, laughing at all the jokes. And she loves, like, seeing media about teenagers. You know, you're always kind of looking at the next age group up, right? So when you're 7, 8, 9, something like that, you're looking at tweeners and young teens. And I think this is the first time that the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles have actually felt like teenagers to me. Not grown-ups playing teenagers, they felt like kids. So I really think the movie is made with a lot of heart, and I'm happy to see that it is much more reflective of a modern setting. Like, so many things about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, having originally been written in the 80s, don't last. They don't hold up to a modern setting. You've got to let some of that stuff go. And I think in a way where a lot of the Marvel comics are kind of circling 40-year-old man babies like me, this feels like a fresh retake that actually serves up a different experience for younger consumers. So I'm really happy to see that. Those of us who want the dark and the edgy and the grimy, we can look to, the game that's coming out? Ronin? The Last Ronin. So that's going to be for people like me. I really love that Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is hitting this resurgence. We've got the Cowabunga collection, we've got Shredder's Revenge, some really fun co-op brawler video games, old school video games. Then if I want to take the series darker, I've got Ronin. But if I want to share this with my daughter, Mutant Mayhem is fun, and it's bright, and it's vibrant, and the animation is incredible. It feels like it's that sketchbook, hard pen ink style art, which, I mean, again, that appeals to me because that was what the old comic books were. They were just black and white, hard pen ink, so beautiful. So I can't recommend it highly enough, but you have to kind of let go of, if you grew up with it like me and you're in your 30s or 40s, you kind of have to let go. You have to kind of like give it to the next generation. And I feel like too much media tries to hold on to this for us. And, you know, we're talking about anthropomorphic talking karate reptiles. Like, it's okay to let that go and let a new generation of film and TV fans kind of find new ways to tell stories with those characters. I really feel like this is one of the reasons why Marvel and DC feel so stale. Like, Superman keeps getting more and more power creep. We want to make them edgier and darker and edgier and darker and edgier and darker. And you're like, we're not really bringing new people into the fold then. You know, Superman should be a Boy Scout and Batman should be sort of a Greek tragedy. And, you know, Spider-Man used to get hurt. I was paging through like Maximum Carnage. And, like, Maximum Carnage starts off, it's a Spider-Man story in the 90s, and, like, it starts off with Spider-Man breaking some ribs. And, like, he's hurt the whole, like, first half of this story of him fighting Carnage and dealing with Venom, and the setups are ridiculous. You just randomly walk into other superheroes and other supervillains, and it's over the top and gaudy and cartoony, and it's hilarious. Like, Maximum Carnage is such a great series. But it was written for kids. And Spider-Man wasn't this, you know, supremely all-powerful, you know, stronger than Captain America and faster than Wolverine and could heal incredibly fast. Like, he's hurt through most of that series over, like, a 2 or 3 day spread. And you're like, that used to happen. I don't know if you remember, what was it? It was the X-Men animated series where Wolverine fights Sabretooth, and then the next episode, Wolverine is still healing from his fight with Sabretooth. We've power creeped these characters up to a place where they're uninteresting, but they're gratifying to old guys. And you're like, oh, if I were Wolverine, I could heal instantly, and then it's this kind of like man-baby authoritarianism. Look, I'm 40, but I want Superman to be able to move planets in our solar system. That's not interesting. That's not fun. kills a lot of storytelling potential. Short story, incredibly long. Dave Burns, if you want grim, edgedark, you've got Invincible, you've got The Boys, you've got, what was it, Jupiter's Legacy? Jupiter's Legacy is the other one that's kind of like an alt take on a Justice League kind of scenario. You've got all this other media. Let Justice League be, you know, super friends and be a little lighter for people to find and then for other people to kind of discover and bring something modern to those stories. And TMNT, that's a good property to do that with. Mutant Mayhem, I think, sticks the landing on that really well. I have to admit, because I don't want to give away the ending. Getting to the ending, I was tearing up a little bit because this is an ending I've never seen for the Ninja Turtles before. That had an impact on me. And again, this I'm getting emotional here because this is something I'm sharing with my daughter. I'm very sentimental like that. But just for me having been a lifelong fan of this property, the movie does something I don't think I've ever seen done before. And to me, that was this huge gap. There's been this huge hole in the mythos of the Ninja Turtles, this empty resolution that we've never achieved with any other version of this story. And this movie sticks the landing on that in a really sweet way. So I'd give it a shot. Again, if you're into this kind of stuff, give it a run. Imagine it through the eyes of an 8 to 10-year-old, and I think you're going to have a blast. Let me take a drink of coffee, and we can get into some housekeeping here. Aditya Anil, the TMNT Extended Universe. We were making a joke on the Discord, like, I can't wait for Casey Jones to invent time travel, and then we will have the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle multiverse, where the live-action turtles meet up with the CG live-action turtles and make fun of the 90s cartoon do-gooder turtles, and then the comic book turtles kill everybody because they're grim and dark. And then everyone goes, whoa, you are so edgy and dark. Yes, Skiptifer, it helps. Like, you want to see more because of the ending that they gave us. Skiptifer says the ending definitely makes the next one much more interesting. Obviously, Nickelodeon is looking at this as a franchise potential. We know everyone's going into these movies wanting to create the next cinema universe. Excuse me. But I feel like this one actually earns a sequel because it's its own self-contained story. It feels a lot like how good the ending is on Into the Spider-Verse. Miles Morales, Into the Spider-Verse. Yeah, sorry. Because there's Into the Spider-Verse, Across the Spider-Verse, and Beyond the Spider-Verse. First one. The first Miles Morales movie. Blah, blah, blah. My brain melted down there. It's its own film. Part two is really good, but it depends on there being a part three, right? So I don't love how trilogies are always structured. I wish the ending of part two were a little more self-contained. Mutant Mayhem feels a lot like that first Miles Morales film. It's its own contained story. You get an ending. And then if they do make more, that's awesome. I'll be really excited. That I'm happy. But if we never get another one, I doubt we'll never get another one. If we never get another one, I had a completely contained bubble of mutant mayhem, and I'm stoked. Simon says, Hypno, subscribed with Prime, subscribed for 28 months, currently on a 5-month streak. Wah, bow, 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 bow. Thank you so much, Simon and McCorkran. Thank you for supporting the podcast. Really appreciate it. Especially when I go off on a tangent talking about comic books and Ninja Turtles for 10 minutes. All right. Oh, geez. Go Starscream. When are we going to get TMNT Avengers collab movie? Because we might end up getting a G.I. Joe and Transformers movie in the future. So many toy properties. I just can't. All right, folks. Last week was an interesting transition week. To air a little laundry, a little BTS here, and that's for behind the scenes, not K-pop. I've been working with a couple companies to do some sponsored videos. my summer was supposed to be front-loaded. So, like, in June and in the beginning of July, I was supposed to have all these videos out and showing some of this stuff, like, taking it on a road trip and traveling with it and doing some cool stuff. So that didn't happen, and now as we're halfway through August, I'm finally getting to show more of the products and stuff that I was trying to do. So one of the major videos that we finally put out was this bad boy right here, the AnchorMake M5C. So this is a new 3D printer from AnchorMake. It's streamlined. It's very easy to set up. I am a complete and total noob when it comes to 3D printing. I have done very little in the world of 3D printing, just dabbled with a few of my friends' printers and some makerspace stuff, but, like, very inexperienced. And the big claim here is that not only is it easy to set up, but it's using the same extruder and motors as the slightly more expensive, the slightly more upscale M5, which has, like, AI cameras and error detection and all this fancy stuff on it. For $399, this is one of the fastest consumer-grade 3D printers on the market. You compare it to the size of, like a good example would be Monoprice sells a good starter 3D printer that I almost bought just to kind of tinker with. And depending on the model, depending on the software, and depending on what you're trying to print, big dependings, the AnchorMake is almost 5 times faster. And it only costs about 30% more. So I got some comments on this video like, ugh, it's overpriced. And you're like, I get that if the idea is you just want a functional machine that can print out some cool plastic pieces and some fun DIY projects, then yeah, that's true. You can get a comparable printer in print size for like $100 less. But it is really cool when you see those motors kicking at full speed and it is just building this project up and it takes like a quarter the time. That is pretty sweet. So I definitely have some concerns. It's very app-based, so you have the AnchorMake app that sends stuff wirelessly over to the printer, and I do wish there was just a little bit more monitoring capability. Like, if there's a problem with your print, you might not get an error message, depending on what the error might be. But again, for a starter printer to work this fast, have an all-metal hot end, like, It's a pretty good starter printer. So I've got a full shakedown on this, and I'm looking at a couple of projects coming up where I want to make some camera kit adapters and mounts and stuff for some of my smartphone cameras. So I'll try to do a follow-up, like, what does it really look like to try and design a lens housing or some sort of lens adapter for a phone? I'm really looking, especially because, like, with my Xiaomi, we already have a filter on there, so it shouldn't be tremendously difficult to look at that and say, how do I get like an anamorphic adapter to clip on to this strange lens housing? So it should be pretty fun. In videos I scrambled, this was a story that kind of hit the news. We're not going to really cover this for the podcast this week, but YouTube's been making a lot of changes, and they've been cracking down even harder on viewers. So, like, for example, there's a whole new wave of stories coming out in different regions. If you're using an ad blocker, you're going to see YouTube put even more harsh, like, blank screens. So, like, you might get a 60-second, you know, just a warning page from YouTube that ad blockers will no longer be allowed. And one of the other things that I'm not a big fan of, but I think this is a gift in disguise, is your watch history. So let's say you went through and you turned off YouTube's watch history back in the day. Well, now YouTube is going to serve you with a blank homepage. And this is designed to kind of freak people out. Your watch history is off. You can change your setting at any time to get the latest videos tailored to you. So they're no longer going to give just random recommendations. They're now going to ask you to go into your Google settings and change your watch history from there. it is very difficult to find where those Google settings live. So if you go to YouTube, and Dave actually showed me this, if you go to youtube.com and you click on the left three, the hamburger menu, and you go down into like your watch, it's like buried three steps deep, but there is a watch history there. It's not the full data that they collect on you from your Google account. So where Google sends you for the watch history is off of YouTube. And if you don't get both of those settings, the setting that's on YouTube and the setting that's attached to your full Google account, it doesn't really nuke the data. So I turned it on just to kind of do the demonstration for screenshotting on my video. It's two separate settings. And when I cleared data, it cleared from one side, but it didn't clear everything from the other. So you kind of have to get both. I think that's really scummy. Because in these watch history warnings, they're going to take you directly to that Google setting. But if you try to search for it or find it on your own, it is incredibly difficult to find where that second setting lives. And to me, that's something that deserves regulatory examination. Like, that's a really anti-consumer move. I think that's pretty scummy of YouTube. But here's the deal. My YouTube has not kicked over. I have watch history off. I went to both places, nuked all the data, and I still have a live YouTube homepage. But I kind of want it to blank out. So the commentary that I'm trying to host here is one where instead of just randomly eating whatever Google serves, like, take the time to subscribe to some people and bookmark your subscriptions page. And when you bookmark that subscriptions page, you go immediately to a more chronological listing of all the new videos that are coming your way. So I actually think that this is a gift. I think this is a blessing in disguise. I know Google is going to freak out more people. They'll go and turn on their notification settings. They just want to be served content, and they don't care that an algorithm is warping their brain. But I think anyone with even just a little bit of taste, like, turn YouTube into the place where you go for something specific. Don't use these sites as the place to just, like, burn time and while away the day. So I am actually very positive. I'll be very happy when my YouTube.com experience is just a simple search bar. I'm here for it. I'm ready for it. That's what I want. I don't want the random servings that YouTube and Google know everything about me. And their recommendations are almost never right. And the ads they serve borderline, like, harm my mental health. Like, they're things I don't want to see. And yet, they know everything about me. They could be making targeted, strategic, near-perfect recommendations on videos to watch. And they would be able to bring products and services to my attention that I would actually enjoy engaging with. If I can go to Instagram and scroll through my feed and stop on something and say, actually, that does look like a cool little gadget. There have been numerous times, I've never bought anything through Instagram, but there have been numerous times where I've stopped and said, oh, that looks kind of cool. I've never done that with YouTube. So YouTube is really using advertisers and the audience and leveraging them against paying for services like YouTube Premium. It's like they're purposely making YouTube bad, so that then we'll go and pay them directly to make YouTube less bad. I'm going to give you money just to recreate part of the experience I used to have on YouTube. It's so bad. Dave Burns, turns out Google was evil all along. Roll Scooby-Doo end credits. Scooby-Dooby-Doo, where are you? But yeah, so bookmark your subscriptions feed. You will enjoy YouTube quite a bit more. I do want to get this just kind of included here. This is an editorial that I just finished on the Patreon. I published it last night. Folding phone durability, what should consumers expect? And this is going to dovetail into our conversation this week as we take a look at the Xiaomi Fold 3. I'm very frustrated by the current conversation surrounding foldable phones. There's not a lot of education being put out there. I don't think these companies that are making the phones are doing a very good job of demonstrating the expected use. And so I break down a couple of companies that are making foldables, and I kind of look at some of the ads that they've been putting out. We know, if you go to a major YouTube tech channel and you see the millions of subscribers, if every one of their videos reached every one of their subscribers, we would be looking at maybe 1% of the overall smartphone buying market. So we know that consumers are not turning to tech YouTubers for any kind of practical education on what to expect from these things. I think a lot of consumers look at their phone as some kind of commodity device that's a communicator, does basic stuff to keep them connected, and they check their email on it, and that's about it. It always comes as a shock to people when I show them what I do on my phone versus what they do on their phones. So I know they're not watching my videos to any great degree. Beyond like some of these tech YouTube channels, I also don't think it's instructive to just break a foldable on camera. Like, there's got to be a lived-in experience somewhere between I never take it outside and I baby it over shag carpet, and that's the only way that I'll use it, to I got it on day one and I immediately tried to do something that I know would break it. The real lived-in consumer experience is somewhere between those two bookends, right? So it's up to the manufacturers to help educate consumers on what that should look like. So I look at Samsung, I look at Oppo, I look at Xiaomi, I look at Google, and I look at Honor. And I kind of break down, these are some of their ads. What expectations would consumers have if they saw that ad and then they decided to take a foldable for a spin? And what's realistic and what's not? And so that's on the Patreon. I think probably next week that might go live on somegadgetguy.com. But it was just kind of irking me, because even for me, I'll get into these conversations with PR reps, and when I'll ask them, like, hey, I shoot video, where should I shoot video? They don't have good answers for me. And they start to take it like I'm criticizing the product, but genuinely, they aren't contributing to that conversation. And I think it's irresponsible of me to be like, hey, I live out in rocky, hilly horse trails and hiking paths and mountain biking trails, and like, do we really think a foldable should be used out there? I have the Pixel. I want to shout out Michael Peppertech. Michael Peppertech is a pretty good dude. And on Best of Our Week last Thursday, he hipped me to East Coup. I think that's how you pronounce it. So this is a really inexpensive two-panel case for the Pixel Fold. Hashtag Team Pixel, hashtag gift from Google for the actual phone. But I bought a glass screen protector for the outer display, and I bought this case from East Coup. But Michael Peppertech hooked me up with this recommendation that for like $12, it's a really nice, almost sandstone-y kind of grip. It's got just like some nice coverage around the corners, just a little bit of a lip by the hinge so that it kind of helps protect if you were to have a corner drop. Your hinge is probably going to get borked, but it should help a little. And for something so inexpensive, it works so much better than I was expecting it to. Like, this is the kind of case I always wished we could have gotten for the Surface Duo. The panel cases we got on the Duo were terrible. And this one is surprisingly good. So even though I've got this now in a case, outer glass screen protector, I still don't feel comfortable shooting a bunch of video of me taking it out into my neighborhood, out into the hilly, rocky, dusty, sandy suburbs, and shoot video of me opening to use the tablet. To me, this is like I'm using it as a phone in all of those conditions, and then when I can sit down somewhere safe, that's when I'll open it up and use that more fragile plastic inner display. But trying to have that conversation with PR and with some of the people that have worked on manufacturing these things, I don't know that they've got good expectations on how and where these products should be used. They still feel kind of like beta tests, where we're putting these things out as consumer-facing products, but we kind of need to see how often they fail, and we kind of need to see how they get damaged by real world use. And to me, that's a very anxiety inducing place to launch a product. So, Sorry, Dave, I'm not sure I completely understand it. Someone that advertises on Google, you have to do so much. I think you're saying you have to do so much BS work to actually target your audience. Okay, I think I understand what you're saying. Yeah, I would imagine that Google's tools and utilities are probably not very hospitable to the people that are actually giving them money to advertise on their platforms. And I think that's kind of reflected in the sorts of ads that I get served on YouTube. That's pretty funny. Ghost Starscream. But the Z Flip 5 lasted 400,000 folds in a 160-hour live stream, and the Razer Plus only lasted 123,000 folds. Sure. No, I saw that too. And again, I appreciate what they're trying to contribute to this conversation. But the thing that's really frustrating is one phone versus one phone is not indicative of a trend. Like, it is entirely possible that you got a great iteration of a Samsung panel and a mediocre iteration of a Moto panel, and that someone duplicating that test in 6 months' time, like, could have those results reversed. And it's impossible to know with one phone versus one phone. And it's the thing, I always take it back. If you go to Pocket Now and you search for Oppo Factory Tour or something like that, I shot 360-degree video of an invitation. What was it? It was the Oppo... It was around the time I think the OnePlus 5 had come out. It was the Oppo R series that was sort of the cousin phone to the OnePlus 5, I think. Anyway, I shot 360-degree video. Every manufacturing line is sacrificing dozens of phones to see different degrees of durability in unique one-off tests. So you get one phone and you put it on like a pin, and then you wrap fabric over it, and a machine pulls to flex against that singular point of pressure as if you were sort of sitting on the phone in a pocket. And they'll sacrifice like five phones a day just to that test. They're not taking one phone and dropping it a dozen times and then moving it to another thing to flex it a dozen times and then moving it to another thing to like squish it a dozen times. Each individual durability test, multiple phones are getting sacrificed to that one test. The worst ones, and this, the sound of it was like nails on a chalkboard to me, was the tumbler test, where they'd have like five or six large tumblers, like almost like dryers, like little like divots and bumps and stuff in the tumbler. They drop a phone in and then just run it in the tumbler, and the phone just keeps getting dropped and banged and bumped and collided with the inside of this tumbler. And then they just see, like, how did it survive? They have an expected tolerance for what the phone should look like at the end of that procedure. I have to believe the manufacturers who are making these folding phones have more data on what the expected durability of a folding phone should resemble. And it's not really being reflected in their advertising. Like, what we need to see is now they take that data, and when they show you a video of someone using their phone in a 30 or 60 second ad, they're using the phone in context. Right now, think about like most of the folding phone video and websites that we see. It's like this nebulous void where a folding phone is floating in space and opening and closing, like animated all on its own. We used to make, the FTC went after toy commercials that showed toys working through like kind of stop motion animation, because that was deemed irresponsible advertising to target to kids. I kind of feel like a computer animated folding phone flapping like a butterfly with no hands operating the phone is kind of violating the spirit of that advertising authenticity and accuracy. So... It's galling, because like we could be doing a better job of showing what these things could do, and it can't be on us YouTubers. Like I said, maybe 1% of the entire global smartphone buying audience, the entire consumer smartphone experience, maybe, and this is me being generous, maybe 1% are tuning in regularly for tech videos on YouTube. So we are not the tip of the spear for this type of educational opportunity. It has to come from the companies that are spending millions and billions marketing their products. I wrote an editorial. The editorial is more succinctly explained than what I just rambled on through here. Oh, see, Dave, this is what I'm actually very, very frustrated by. See, but one, you should do research before you do anything. If you're tricked by marketing, that's on you. You didn't reason and logic hard enough. I do kind of feel that way, but I also know that we're not going to change consumer behavior, right? I can keep putting out tips and tricks videos and, like, you know, technical deep dives and benchmarks and all this stuff. I didn't do it all. No one's going to watch it. I might get like 10,000 views, right? No one's sharing this stuff. No one's consumers aren't looking to be educated. They're looking more to have their bias confirmed. They already bought something and they want someone to tell them that they bought something nice. So unfortunately, my channel is not the channel to affect change. I feel it needs to be regulators looking at the marketing and advertising of these products and saying, you're not really, you know, sort of priming consumers for what it's like to own a $2,000 bendy tablet, or you're misrepresenting what your competitors are doing. And I feel like that's another one. Like, Apple should be tagged on that really hard. Like, Apple's main marketing strategy now is everything's broken but us. There was a whole series of social media ads that are going out in India where, I mean, did you know that Android phones can't even scan QR codes? Yeah, according to Apple, if you have an Android phone, it's going to stutter, it's going to lag, it won't work, everything's broken on it, and it can't even scan QR codes. So you should just buy an iPhone. And you're like, that should actually be against the law. Because so many of the things that are broken in the relationship between iPhones and Android phones are all Apple's fault. So whenever Apple does something that breaks compatibility, they always make it look like their competitors are the problem. And to me, that should be illegal. So it's pretty great. No, Dave Burns. I mean, you're trying to solve the problem. Google Lens on the search bar, you can scan QR codes. No. Apple said you can't. So now people will take that as read. Journalists won't push back against Apple's commercials at all. They'll pick apart the nuance of a Google Pixel commercial, but Apple said that Androids can't scan QR codes. So I guess that's kind of the truth. As long as Apple said it, then that's, let me see if I can find it. This really wasn't what I was gonna, I wasn't gonna add this to the show today, but let me see if I can find the tweet. And I should actually credit people when they send stuff. One of the stories is coming by way of Dave Burns, but I wanna set this up here. Okay, so this was shared by Root Knight on the private Discord. And here, let me screen share this. And I'm going to go to @imacidtwts. Sorry, Sid, I have no idea what your X user handle is supposed to look like. But Apple India should really stop with their misleading advertisements. A thread. Take this advertisement, for example. Akshay G literally says that his old Android phone couldn't even scan QR codes. The keyboard wouldn't show all numbers and often misclicks. So lame. So these are these little Animoji commercials that Apple is peppering across social media. And I think some of this is getting like traditional media distribution on like television too. But this is an ad in India where Androids can't scan QR codes. So you should buy a $1,000 iPhone. So this one I actually think is probably true, unfortunately. Chirag claims that his old Android phone heated up a lot and stopped responding, so he heads to the fridge to get ice. Well, so if you had a Samsung fabbed 8 Gen 1, actually that one might have been true. Anjali claims that her iPhone is chill, but in my experience, iPhones have one of the worst thermal management systems. iPhones heat up a lot when gaming or when under direct sunlight. This is misleading. And he actually goes on to, like, link a whole bunch of static images, too. Using the Move to iOS app, I transferred all my data to the iPhone. I used to game with glitches. Now my experience is seamless. I keep it cool when I game. So does my iPhone. These are all just random, like, supposed to be real-life consumer quotes, but something tells me they're probably not actual testimonials from Apple. But this is it. This is a major marketing campaign in India where Apple is grossly misrepresenting the comparable experience between iPhones and Androids. And if these are actual testimonials, I'd be very surprised if we were talking about true comparable experiences. I'd be very surprised if we were talking about $1,000 iPhones to $1,000 Oppos or $1,000 Vivos, right? I think instead we'd probably be looking at someone who had an old beat up Realme, and like, oh geez, I can't do anything. It doesn't even have like NFC on it. And you're like, okay, but that's not an oranges to oranges comparison. But again, that's a part of Apple's marketing now, is to overstate their capabilities and make their competitors look like they're non-functional and broken. So now you all know that Android phones can't scan QR codes. So we should all just buy iPhones. So we should spend $1,000. The average selling price of an iPhone right now is closing in on $1,000 just so we can do something basic like scan a QR code. And that's what Apple marketing is encouraging. It's pretty gross. So let me take another drink of coffee here, and I can try and catch up on what's happening here in the chat.
Hey, podcast listeners, I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Skip to fur. Wait, I can't scan QR codes? Dave Burns, they made the icon look like a camera and a QR code. It's pretty easy. But you know, they didn't brand it well. Google Lens, who could possibly imagine what that would be? What you needed to call it was like Apple iVision QR scanner. You need an Apple brand name, and then people will understand. It can't be mixed reality. It's got to be spatial computing. We invented spatial computing. What is spatial computing? It's mixed reality. Skip to fur. I should probably let my phone know that it shouldn't do that. It's not supposed to be able to. Oh, one hell of a fanboy. I'm imagining these are pretty common, especially internationally. We have these Animoji ads in Turkey, too, very misleading and cringy. And again, they receive no pushback. There is no journalistic examination of Apple's marketing here. It always comes like years later after a class action. We showed the iPhone getting blasted with water jets and hit it with cakes in an aerodynamic testing flight chamber. And it took like a year later for Australia to go, hey, you know what? that probably misrepresents the durability of the phone. You should probably not air that commercial anymore. And you're like, damage has been done. You let Apple run that ad. And then, it's probably not good. One hell of a boy. One lady talking there was how her iPhone was asking before it can use location data to make her feel safer. Like, Android doesn't do that. And it's even better when you look at, like, Apple making those kinds of claims, and then they unleash a hellish product like AirTags. We considered no one safety, but we put this product out at scale. But it's rife for abuse. And now, every other competitor is trying to fix that problem, but we're kind of kicking our heels back because whenever we contribute, it'll make their products viable. So the reason why you can't buy Google location tags or Chipolo or Pebblebee or Tile compatible Android tags is because Apple has not fixed the iPhone to warn about tracker abuse. So that's it. I'm sitting on pre-orders for Chipolo and Pebblebee, and I can't get them, and I can't do videos on them, and I can't talk about Android's version of a Find My network because Apple is profiting by slowing down development on tracker warnings on the iPhone. We're all waiting for Apple to do it so that we can finally push this out. And if Google just put the products out, you know for a fact that every single techie out there would be, I can't believe Google would violate people's privacy like this. What about all the iPhone users? Google didn't even consider all the iPhone users. You've got to make things safe for them, even though it's just for Android devices, without ever acknowledging that that situation is built because Apple said F you to Android users and people who owned older iPhones. But that's where we're at. Again, people's like, oh, Apple gets all kinds of criticism. Do they? I don't think they do. Next up, we'll talk about Apple ripping off IP for their smartwatch and then still being allowed to sell their smartwatch. Oh, I gotta stretch. Oh, and J-Man says I need to hydrate. I should probably take a drink of water, not just coffee. We should get into the news block, because we're already almost an hour in. Well, no, technically we're like 40 minutes in, because it took me like 6 minutes to figure out my microphone. Hold on just a sec. Yeah, fat produce. Apple really is the prime example of how regulations are desperately needed in the tech industry. Everyone say hey to my buddy Andrew. What's up, fat produce? So, the news block, I think we can hit this pretty quick. All of the stories, all of the housekeeping, all of the show notes, and everything that we're going to be talking about is going to be available on this week's blog post on somegadgetguide.com, where you can catch the audio replay later on. So you can catch all the links. I've got everything linked here, and I want you to read through these stories a little bit more than I'll be talking about them, because I think there's some interesting trends that I think we should be concerned by. I don't think anything is reaching doom and gloom just yet, but I think these are bad, especially this one, is a bad direction to head. Okay? So the first one is, I am not a journalist. I try to maintain a consistency of discussion where my bias is clearly on display for people to accept or disregard. I want you to know where I'm coming from, but I have an opinion. So I am not an unbiased reviewer. I am an individual with feelings. And if you agree with my feelings, great. But if you disagree with my feelings, you also know what it is about the experience that I'm accentuating, that I'm highlighting. I'm having fun playing with the Pixel Fold and other foldables, but my heart lies with crazy camera phones, right? I'm much more into photography and video and editing and mobile content creation than I am opening and closing a hinge. That was more rambly than it needed to be. So when we look at something that's a little bit more journalistic, news about the news, I think we have to be really careful with this current flavor of the internet going so AI-driven and algorithmically focused. I think CNET has the wrong take on gaming search results. So this is written up by Gizmodo, published by Thomas Germain, I think is how the last name is pronounced. Sorry, Thomas. CNET deletes thousands of old articles to game Google search. Google says depleting old pages... Google says deleting old pages to bamboozle search is, quote, not a thing, as CNET erases its history. From the article, tech news website CNET has deleted thousands of old articles over the past few months in a bid to improve its performance in Google search results, Gizmodo has learned. Archived copies of CNET's author pages show the company deleted small batches of articles prior to the second half of July, but then the pace increased. Thousands of articles disappeared in recent weeks. A CNET representative confirmed that the company was culling stories but declined to share exactly how many it has taken down. The move adds to recent controversies over CNET's editorial strategy, which has included layoffs and experiments with error-riddled articles written by AI chatbots. So just real quick before we kind of talk about this story, JMan150 gifted a Tier 1 sub to Kappa Cash, so thank you very much, and Dalanbit, I'm sorry I've mispronounced your name, also subscribed with Prime. Thank you so much for supporting. And we are almost 60% of the way through a hype train on Twitch. So, thank you so much. I really appreciate the support and the contributions and all of the help on this channel. I think I also missed JMan150 also gifted a Tier 1 sub to Canox80. You get one more because I don't have a soundboard. Been talking about it for years. You check back in this podcast in the year 2032, and I might have taken that transition to having a button that I can press to do wacky sound effects. Oh, Dave Burns gifting a Tier 1 sub to Las Divine. That's a lovely Twitch name. I like Las Divine. That stands for the divine. Thank you so much, Dave. That's really cool of you. I appreciate it. All right. So back to this CNET article. Sorry, I got kind of sidetracked there. Read through the rest of what Gizmodo is talking about, because CNET is a tech. The first pronunciation was correct, Dalanbit. Okay. Good to know. Read through the rest of this Gizmodo article. I fear this is going to be a trend in the way that news organizations are getting ratcheted, because I'm really unhappy with the current state of search. Even though I kind of make the joke like I mostly live on Bing, now one of the things that's really annoying is you put in a search for something and the first result isn't an ad. That was already bad. Now the first result is sort of a chatbot style summation of what an AI language model thinks is the answer to your search. And that's almost never what I need. It's almost never what I'm looking for. And I think companies are going to start looking at some of these strategies. It's important to have an archive. It's important to have a history. It's important to have old results that can show up for relevant searches. And with CNET doing this, it kind of reinforces that crazy... That sort of online spooky creepypasta conspiracy theory of the dead internet. I would highly recommend everybody just go to Wikipedia, type in dead internet theory, and you'll see sort of a listing of like what it is. But to grossly condense it, it's the internet was this vibrant place of creation. And now, even though you type a search into Google and you'll see millions of results for that search, you really don't see lots of results. So like after you get to like page 3 of results through Google, it kind of just loops and it kind of just keeps serving you the same stuff over and over and over again. You never really get deeper. And it used to be a lot more functional for different conditions in your search, like putting quotes or pluses or minuses. Like now I do that stuff in search and it very rarely changes the dynamic of the search. On Bing, on Google, I'm having to go to like increasingly indie search engines. I'm actually thinking about trying to host like a little search. I've been digging really deep into Fediverse stuff, and you can host your own instance of a search engine. So I'd highly recommend checking out what CNET is doing, because I think CNET is unfortunately a current bleeding edge example of how news agencies are starting to react to this new climate of AI-driven language learning models, search, and algorithms. They want more of their sites to get clicks, and if they can manipulate the flow of that search to their articles, then those are the moves they're going to make. And it's not through the benefit of better journalistic standards, better content. It's going to be more, can we make a machine that churns, and then that content evaporates when it's no longer useful or when it doesn't help us with our search results. So I've got to do some huge shout outs here. We've got Fat Produce gifting a tier one sub to Onscon and to Aditya Anil and to Al Zombino and to Tony Surround and El Jefe Reviews, my buddy Jeff in the chat, also subscribed at tier one. They've been subscribed for 49 months on a 49 month streak. That is huge. Andrew and Jeff, thank you so much for all of the support. We're now into level three on this hype train on Twitch. You guys are rocking my socks and blowing my mind, and because I don't have a soundboard. Thank you so much. That is really awesome of you guys, and I really do appreciate it. Let me get this out of the way. Let me get this back here. So the other story of a company dumping stuff. This one actually isn't quite as bad. I actually don't think anyone's going to be too crazy surprised by this development. And this one actually comes courtesy of Dave Burns on the private Discord. Jeff, much love, man. Right back at you. I really appreciate that. And again, if anyone here loves their ears, they should absolutely be subscribed to Jeff's channel. El Jefe Reviews brought me back into taking Bluetooth audio, especially true wireless earbuds, Bluetooth audio more seriously. And he's clued me in. I mean, I was the cranky some audio guy before I was some gadget guy. And this dude schooled me on consumer-facing earbuds, something fierce. So El Jefe Reviews is the real deal. But only if you like your ears. If you hate your ears and you hate listening to good audio and you despise music and great sound design in movies and really awesome sound effects in TV shows and you would rather just never hear anything in good fidelity, do not follow El Jefe Reviews. All right? I think that's fair. Yeah? I think that's good. So, sorry. Our next story of a company dumping excess baggage came courtesy of Dave Burns on the private Discord from CampaignAsia.com. This article, Disney Metaverse chief departs shortly after division shutdown. I don't see who might have... Oh, this is written up by Coral Cripps over at CampaignAsia.com. Michael White was appointed early last year to spearhead the company's metaverse ambitions, is exiting the company shortly after its decision to shut down its dedicated division earlier this year. February 2022, the media supergiant announced its plans to launch a series of metaverse-focused strategies within its storytelling and consumer experiences unit. White, who joined Disney in 2011, was previously the company's senior vice president of consumer experiences at platforms, was appointed by Disney's then chief executive Bob Chapek to front this division. The article goes on to just describe how lots of companies are sort of offloading their ambitions for VR and metaverse content. I think this is a very interesting development to keep an eye on. Okay, you know what? I said that this was going to be a short chunk of the news block. I actually have to expand on this for just a second. Apple really seems to have Facebook in their sights. They are targeting many of the ways that Facebook monetizes data. So when Apple started trumping up, hey, we're going to put in these new privacy controls, they mostly affected Facebook's core business model, core advertising user data business model. And then Apple basically took all that and put it into their own apps and services in ways where how your iPhone tracks everything that you do is sort of independent of your user settings. So even if you say, hey, do all this do not track stuff, Apple sort of reserves their own apps to still kind of leech your data. And then that goes into Apple's own business of selling ads. During Apple's last quarterly financials, that was a major source of revenue. It's a one of their largest and fastest growing sectors of monetizing user behavior. So they went after Facebook something hard. This is me putting on a tinfoil hat. This is my conspiracy theory with no insider knowledge is what's going on with Oculus, what's going on internal to Meta and Facebook, or what's going on internally at Apple. But Facebook was all in on Metaverse, and we saw some progress. Like Disney was out there talking up, hey, we're going to have like Metaverse theme parks experiences for all the poor people who can't afford to travel to a Disney park. You could pay to have a VR experience. We talked about this, I want to say it was about a year ago on this podcast, where it was kind of just, hey, we'll keep the filthy poors entertained with VR, and then the richer and richer and richer people can actually go to Disney parks. It was a very blatant part of one of their Disney days. I think it was D Plus or something like that. Sorry, I'm rambling. But Disney's always been pretty tight with Apple. I mean, often when we talk about some of these experiences, and some of the AR experiences that the phones have showcased have had sort of a Disney chatter somewhere distantly in the background to say, hey, we're looking at bringing some of our IP to these experiences. So Facebook was super, super all in on Metaverse, and I think that's what was sort of keeping the development of Apple's AR strategy working behind the scenes. But as we know, mixed reality headsets are really hard to do well. So I think Apple got stalled in building what ostensibly is now the Vision Pro. And just around the time that Facebook started pulling back from its major metaverse talking points, that's when we saw Apple push go on Vision Pro, even though it wasn't ready. You know, we don't often see Apple products pushed publicly until they're a little closer to being accessible in some way. But Apple then saw, oh no, the chief company that we'd be competing against and trying to make turn into the villain, they're pulling back from their investment in Metaverse. If we don't have Facebook to pick on as the big bad, and we can't point all of our favored journalists to attacking Facebook, then we don't have a major talking point in the Apple marketing strategy. The Apple marketing strategy is make your competitor look like they're evil and incompetent. But if Facebook is pulling back from that and now working on a more social media style strategy to improve revenue, and that's something Apple has really struggled with, is like that social component and AI and language learning models. They're trying to tell investors, no, no, we've been working on this stuff for years, but Siri still sucks. Oh no. So that's why I feel we got the push on Vision Pro. So now all of these companies that were sort of like, that were sort of on board with Metaverse, just because like, oh, well, Facebook's going to do it. We all need to be on this. We're all going to have pages and services and apps and Metaverse things. And it's going to be the sort of standard for VR. So we've got to participate. Well, now they're all pulling out. I don't think Apple's going to make a platform. I think Vision Pro is a dev kit to get people interested in making services, but is Apple going to make their own VR social network? I don't think they are. So this is actually a really big hit to what the viability of a new mixed reality headset in this market might look like. You know, you can always sort of bring back a PlayStation Home type VR experience. There are VR chats for Oculus and for HTC and for like a Valve Index. Apple really isn't good at making all that stuff on their own. They like to claim that they're the progenitor of all of this cool stuff, but really they kind of make something and then they hope their devs can fill in the gaps. The original iPhone couldn't install software, so they hoped that devs would make cool web services that you could log into on a 2G phone radio. Cool. It wasn't until later where they're like, okay, we actually need to make an app store and get developers to make apps for our phones, but like that came later. And I feel like Vision Pro is now kind of stuck in a similar holding pattern. It was either scrap the project because they didn't have the opponent, they didn't have the villain to mischaracterize the quality of the service with Metaverse, or it was push go and hope that they can get enough people on board to make Vision Pro go on their own. But now I'm even more increasingly anxious about the launch of Vision Pro, because if Apple tanks this, if Apple fails to get this up, it's going to set VR and MR and AR back years. And maybe it does need to just restrict back down to an enthusiast level again. I think maybe Oculus blew up too fast, right? It got people too interested too fast, and then the reality of putting a display on your face is a lot more complicated than I think people expected it to be, especially once you start talking about augmented reality. That's still science fiction, right? The ability to like just put on a sleek pair of glasses or pop in some contacts and then see cyborg vision. It doesn't work like that. And it's not going to work like that for a while. So anyway, this story to me kind of landed very quietly, but at just sort of the right time. What are you going to do with your Vision Pro if all of these companies are pulling out of the VR space, of the metaverse space, of the mixed reality space? This is absolutely a trend we need to see, because Vision Pro can come out and then all these companies can reinvest and try to bring stuff. But if there's no platform for them to do it on, they're not going to be interested in spending a ton of money to develop. Like, does Disney really want to build a Disney social media platform for mixed reality for only people that own $3,500 headsets so that they can kind of virtually ride Disney parks rides? I don't think they do. I don't think they want to make that platform. I think they want a platform provided to them where they can more easily contribute some content. And I don't know that Apple's going to be the right partner for making that happen. So, JMan150, we got another gifted tier one sub to DrClaw77. Thank you so much. I love it. Thank you. This entire stream, Fat Produce, JMan150, Dave Burns, these gifted subs, and people resubbing to the stream, that is amazing. And I really appreciate the support. This has been such a fun way to hold this conversation and to interact with all of you fun geeks. So, Delombit, Juan has a conspiracy block now. I mean, I do like to go on kind of a reach, but it's me looking at like what the landscape looks like. Facebook does something, Apple breaks it for them, and then tries to copy it, right? And who was the big player in VR? Oculus, who had the most sort of contained ecosystem with the closest thing resembling a walled garden, Meta. So what did Apple do? They tried to rip off that business model. They ripped off the Tile business model and gave themselves unfair advantages over Tile trackers. Apple isn't innovating. They are now literally cribbing other companies' strategies and then trying to make it look like their competitors are offering a broken experience. But with Facebook pulling out and minimizing their investment in Metaverse, that's got to have a bunch of Apple folk real nervous. Oh no, we waited too long on this Vision Pro thing. What are we going to do? Ah. Ooh, Dave Burns, interesting. Are you implying that public infrastructure, like the World Wide Web, is critical to sustainable commerce? I might be, Dave. And it's not my internet, it's our internet. I do, Jeff. Oh, I totally should. I've done this now enough. We need Juan to get a tinfoil hat prop for this new segment. I really should. Now, something reusable. I don't want to use actual tinfoil because that's a practical, you know, material, and I get anxious about recycling and stuff like that. But maybe something Mylar. And it's real crinkly, and people hate listening to it when it's on mic. Oh, it's so bad. Oh, Kappa Cash. You know, I don't think it's going to be that bad, actually. Kappa Cash says this is Vision Pro equals Air Power 2. So here's the thing. El Jefe agreed. We need a sustainable tinfoil hat. I got into this. I did almost 9 hours of podcasting last week, which is why my voice is still a little flaky today. And I had a 3-hour trek down memory lane with Jason over at Painfully Honest Tech. Jason and I are old audio nerds, and so for so much we see eye to eye, but I really do think sometimes Jason is a little clouded. His fondness for Apple products sort of revisits memories with very rose-tinted glasses sometimes. We got into like a 30-minute debate on what the meaning of the word comparable was, because he was saying, like, I got the comparable Windows laptop, and you're like, not if there was that big of a price difference. They're not comparable machines. And then that took us down a rabbit hole. But we were talking about stuff like Vision Pro. And the thing that's frustrating is, on its own, as a dev kit, not as a consumer-facing product, as a dev kit, there are some really interesting things happening with Vision Pro that could help the overall mixed reality landscape. Like adding more resolution and a beefier processor to the onboard computing. Like, these are things that are actually positive steps for mixed reality, but Apple doesn't contribute. Apple doesn't play nice with anyone else, and they try to make everyone else's products look broken. So instead of really elevating and being a leading force in improving mixed reality, they're trying to roll their own. And I kind of hope it burns them. I kind of hope they fumbled the landing on this one, because I don't want the future course of VR and mixed reality dictated by Apple. I don't believe in their vision for where this might go. But if Apple can sell a $3,500 dev kit, if we take out that stupid front screen that animates your face in a really dumb, uncanny valley way for other people to look at you, if we take that out and we take out some of the unnecessary build sculpting, because it's actually not a very practical build if you look at the metal and glass, the way that it weights on your face, the way that you have to move to an external battery, it's going to be harder to get cooling through that whole apparatus. You want lighter weight materials like high quality plastics. You know, just that doesn't make it nicer when you really put it on your head. And it's also the same problem I have with like AirPods Max. Like, they feel really nice to your fingers, but they're kind of sweaty and heavy on your head. That's not nicer for a travel Bluetooth headphone. You want something more portable, collapsible. To me, that's a better portable experience. But if Vision Pro can at least encourage developers to look at higher resolution, better optics, better power performance through onboard components, then like a next generation Valve or a next generation HTC, maybe it climbs up to $2,000, but it's a more powerful unit with more experience in that manufacturing and better resolution, I'm all for it. If Apple can move the needle on that, then that at least is going to be a bit of a victory. So I don't think it's going to be quite AirPower 2, but I don't believe in Apple's vision. I just hope that this opens up a bit of a buffer. People were just like clutching their pearls at a $1,200 HTC. And you're like, yeah, but it's actually a product you can buy now. Like, you can go and use it today. It's not the promise of something to come, and it's got a much more robust software platform than Vision Pro will have whenever it launches. So I feel like, again, our perspective on that is a little bit skewed by Apple's ability to market the potential of their products, where no other company gets that benefit of the doubt. You know, in HTC, I don't know. I mean, they promise that they're going to bring updates to it, but how would we even know if they can update the product? Apple Vision Pro, it does nothing right now, but it's the promise of spatial computing. Well, Apple will give us those updates. Scott, I think Apple is more of a villain in the mixed AR and VR space, and Rokit and Xreal are like the underdog heroes or something. I mean, I can burn an hour talking about little face displays. I have the Xreal here right in front of me on my desk because the beam has been so much fun to play with. But we can save that for maybe the end of this conversation. I did want to mention real quick, every web browser on the internet is basically the same core code. I should say it's like you've got Safari and then you've got a myriad number of variations on Chrome, or what we say Chromium web browsers. I've always been the contrarian in that regard, but since the Quantum update, I genuinely have preferred using Firefox and Firefox Mobile. But one of the things that really pissed me off about the Quantum update was Firefox Mobile removed the ability to use open extensions from the main desktop version of Firefox. And that really killed me because I've got a bunch of little utilities, like especially for my own home site, I'll do things like search for certain photos and then hit down them all. So I can just download a whole bunch of JPEGs all at once. It's a really handy way to kind of interact with the content that I have uploaded. If I use a video downloader, I can get a better quality version of my own videos back off of YouTube than if I click download through YouTube. So for me, the archival stuff, like a browser plugin, works better than the actual tool that Google gives me. Well, if you're on Firefox Mobile, like I am, you will very much enjoy the news. Prepare your Firefox desktop extension for the upcoming Android release. Firefox will become the only major Android browser to support an open extension ecosystem. So now, with some changes to the way that the extension is built for the desktop version, and also this does change, I mean, it's not a simple just plug and play. Developers also have to go through how the extension sort of calls, because Android likes to kill services or apps that are really, really heavy and resource intense. So if you've got a browser and it's got a ton of extensions, Android loves to nuke that, right? Because it's just killing your battery life. It's eating up all your RAM. That's not a good experience for a mobile. But we can now make these extensions better background services as a part of the browser. And so it does take some work from the developers to sort of get all those pieces in place. But hopefully soon, any extension that's going to work on the desktop version of Firefox with a little work from those devs can now be brought over to the mobile version. And the Firefox browser already has some really good extensions, like ad blockers and like one of my favorite ones is like persistent background playback for things like audio podcasts. So I don't have to keep the screen on just to listen to someone talk, but stream it directly through the browser, stuff like that, that I don't feel you should ever have to pay for. I should never have to pay to use less resources for something like YouTube audio playback. So those types of plugins have already been great. To get even more of the developer community working on extensions is going to be really, really cool, especially if I can get some of those better container tools, right? Like if I don't install Facebook as an app, but every now and then I have to do something on Facebook and I can contain it to its own little bucket. And Facebook isn't allowed to look out at anything else that's happening in my browser, and I can just vice grip it and just starve it of any other information. And getting better tools for stuff like that on my mobile browser would be pretty sweet. So just keep an eye out. Updates coming to Firefox. If you've maybe tried Firefox in the past, or you didn't maybe like after one of the more recent updates, if they changed some stuff, I think now would be a really good time to give Firefox another spin. I've been using it consistently my default browser on both Windows and Android for a couple of years now. And I really like the experience there. Dave Burns. Okay, cool. Now do progressive web app installs on desktops. It's not perfect. No, there's a lot of room to grow. Oh man, McCorkran and Simon. Just wait till Apple invents iFoil hat. McCorkran, you mean the iTinfoil hat? All right, so that gets us through the news block. You know, the hour that I set aside for the news block. This is where we used to have a subreddit plug. I got a couple comments from people, just mod mail on Reddit. I genuinely have not been on Reddit since I shuttered Glowing Rectangles, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. And I popped in briefly to talk about the Rokid station and the X-Real beam. So there are subreddits. So I like to play with the Samsung Dex subreddit, the Rokid subreddit, and the X-Real subreddit. And I popped in just to like, you know, hey, I tried this and this kind of worked. Or, oh, if you combine this with that, that's kind of fun. And then I basically left Reddit again. I just genuinely have not, I genuinely don't want to support the direction that the executive team at Reddit is trying to take their site. And I think it harms the communities that really utilize their service and their platform. And I haven't found the same exact replacement for what Reddit offered. There's a Fediverse version that you can play with. I'm using Lemmy, L-E-M-M-Y, not the, you know, the singer of a hard rock band, but a platform of platforms. And I think it's more confusing than it needs to be. And every version of Lemmy is kind of its own copy of a version of Reddit. And I think that makes organizing communities too difficult. But it has been fun just for stuff to scroll through. My main solution has been to recommend people go back to using an RSS feed reader. If what you used Reddit for was to just like find new content and have it organized into topics that you care about, instead of using an algorithm, go back and roll your own. And I think that actually is the best, going back old school internet, go back to an RSS reader. But above all, I just like would like to use this part of the podcast to say that the mission of my subreddit is still alive. Glowing Rectangles was a place to help content creators by sharing content you felt deserved more attention. And now with this explosion of social media competitors like Blue Sky and Threads and Mastodon getting a huge surge of users, there are still those opportunities. There are still those experiences to contribute to those conversations. It's not as easy to find, and it's not as easy to organize without using a platform like Reddit. But wherever you're sort of experiencing that, it still means a lot to the content creators involved to try and broaden the conversation, to bring more folks to talk about this stuff. Like I said at the top of this, like, take a look at the audiences of the biggest tech YouTube channels available, and that is a critically small number of people when we look at the entire potential audience of people who might want to learn how to use their phone better, or might be shopping for a different kind of device, or instead of like always just believing the marketing or getting whatever is just sort of handed to them at a carrier store, there are other ways that we can do outreach and support, and we can bring people to these conversations. So there's no place for me to point you. Instead, I'm imploring people to share the content that they feel is good, and don't fall for the trap of sharing and commenting on the content that you feel is crap. If someone's out there putting out articles that are sort of lazily investigated and come to incorrect conclusions, if you try to point out their badness, you bring more attention and more traffic to those articles. If someone's putting out a video and it's total clickbait, calling them out on it improves their interactions and engagements and brings more traffic to their strategy. So it works. They don't have to put out good, well thought out, well produced videos. They can put out garbage and it pisses people off, and then they complain about it, and then that's free advertising. So every single time you see something that frustrates you, what I would ask you to do instead of sharing it or condemning it or commenting it or thumbs downing it, I would ask that you ignore it. Try to mute the creator that put out that lazy content, and instead go dig up an El Jefe Reviews video. I mean, I've been doing that for a little bit. Like, hey, this article I read was so frustrating and upsetting that what I want to do is share something that I think you should watch instead. And a video from Jeff talking about some killer earbuds is so much more fun than someone with a bad hot take on a less popular phone. Oh, how do you even say Sony Xperia 1iV? Oh, I can't even use my hands. It's so skinny. No. You can bounce off with all that. Instead, I'd rather, you know, highlight a Hugh Jeffries video, which is what we're going to transition to right here after I drink some coffee.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people. Producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Are you in the market for a new pair of headphones, Bluetooth speaker, or some true wireless earbuds? Then you've come to the right place. I'm here to help you make better audio purchasing decisions. From budget brands like Empow, Taltronics, to more well-known brands like Sony, Sennheiser, and AKG, I'm reviewing them all, including Soundcore and one more. My name is Jeff, also known as El Jefe Reviews all over the internet, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And I make tech reviews of audio products from a regular person's perspective. I answer the questions so you know what to buy, what works, and what doesn't. So before you make that purchase decision, make sure you check out one of my full reviews, and that way you get all the info you need to make a better decision with your money.
Dave Burns, my old app no longer fully works, and the full Reddit app recommended R. Peter explains the joke, so I left Reddit. Yeah, the front page on Reddit for me, the last time I was really digging in, and I was chatting with the folks at the X-Reel subreddit, whew, the front page was not looking good. Even with me being subscribed to a whole bunch of stuff, like, the engagement has completely shifted. It's so funny when, like, the CEO, excuse me, got some massive coffee burps there. When the CEO of Reddit is like, ugh, all the people complaining are like 5% of all the people who use Reddit. So why should we listen to them complain about our changes? You're like, yeah, that was the 5% who were doing the most work moderating and submitting content. And boy, does it show how very different the experience is on Reddit with a lot of those people. Kind of chilling their engagement with Reddit. Those communities are not nearly as well cultivated and as well supplied. And it shows on that front page. It's dark. Oof. So bad. Kenox 80. By the way, Juan, GDC did a piece on development of your favorite game, Vampire Survivors. Thought I'd share it here since this is the only place I listen to you. Thanks, Kenox. I'll upload more of my videos to Twitch. I could go back to doing that. For a while there, it was like I was actually getting some decent traffic on videos uploaded directly to Twitch. For anyone who's interested, because we're now officially into the second half of our podcast here. 10:30 in the morning. Vampire Survivors in beta now has couch co-op, and Lex and I finished a 30-minute run. I gotta tell you, it is very difficult to build a character if the person you're doing co-op with has the attract orb, because they can suck up all of the little experience gems before your character can get to them, and it is a surprising challenge getting to end game and having a really well-built character, but the couch co-op is really fun. So I would highly recommend, if you're a fan of Vampire Survivors and you have a second controller and you know someone else who can operate that controller, to sit them down and to play around, because it's pretty great. I really like it. This game has just been such a gem. And like, I've now purchased it twice, you know, purchased the game and all of the DLC on both Android and PC. So great. So great. I mean, just really has been a labor of love from the developers. So I'll read that piece. That sounds really interesting, how this little like indie and kind of defined an entire new genre of roguelite, which is just really exciting when something breaks through. And it really does kind of change some of the way that we think about these games. Let's see. Dave Burns. Hugh Jeffries just hates perfection, which is why he is so critical of Apple. Yeah, I guess. This is exactly what we're going to be talking about here. Oh, I wish it wouldn't autoplay. I was trying to get the thumbnail back. Sorry, Hugh. Let me see if I can just skip to an internal shot. That'll look better. Oh, that doesn't look better. Hold on. This entire podcast. There, that looks better. Okay. So, I'm a big fan of iFixit. I think iFixit does the best teardown content, really carefully taking apart a product to look at what goes inside of it. And then they come out with these scores like, do we think that this is a product that could be easily repaired? A scale of 1 to 10. And they gave the new MacBook Pros a 4, which in the grand scheme of things, especially from an Apple product, is actually kind of progress. But I always wait to sort of reserve my complete view of Apple until Hugh Jeffries gets his hands. I know he's probably got some help producing his videos, but it's him, it's his channel. I usually wait until Hugh Jeffries has a chance to sort of do some of these component swaps, because that's where we really start to see some of the challenges of repairing a product. And unfortunately, Apple is now one of the leaders in our industry who is most responsible for breaking the right to repair. They are serializing parts. They are telling software that you can't replace different pieces. They're breaking functionality on the products. And they do it in ways that makes it look like the repair shop would have been the problem. Again, they're really good at making their competitors look like they're the problem. But the reason why this stuff doesn't work is because of Apple. So in Hugh Jeffries' most recent video, he took a look at MacBook Pros. And he did things like taking apart screens and then replacing screens. And he has two identical MacBook Pros. So it's not like he's using off-brand parts. It's not like he's, you know, taking a cheap panel and putting it into a MacBook and the MacBook says, no, that's not a good enough panel. He's taking one panel off of a MacBook to put it on another. And when he does stuff like that, the Mac knows that it's not the panel that it was originally built with, and it does this stuff where it like purposely discolors and breaks part of the display. So if you were as a consumer were to see that, after taking your MacBook to a third-party repair shop, you would blame the shop for screwing up the repair. You would say, hey, you damaged the new panel, or you didn't install it correctly. Look, all of this is broken. And then you would take it to an Apple store, and they'd probably just replace the whole laptop. First of all, they probably aren't doing this type of repair because it's extremely time intensive. That's another thing that Hugh Jeffries shows off, is like just taking these MacBooks apart. We're talking about dozens and dozens of different kinds of screws. So some of them are standard little mini screws, some of them are Torx, some of them are Pentalobe, some of them are security screws. They're all different lengths and sizes and places. There are screws that are attaching to things with very fragile ribbon cables that if you're not exceedingly careful in disassembly, like you could tear that cable and then it would be, you know, basically you'd kill the laptop at that point. But getting to the end of this, there's so much where the logic board will communicate with the lid sensor. So again, now the lid sensor is a proprietary Apple part so that when you close the lid, it doesn't go to sleep properly. And again, what would the expectation be? I took my laptop to this third-party repair shop, and now my Mac won't even go to sleep. Makes the repair shop look like they're incompetent when really it's a proprietary part locked to Apple software that only Genius Bar members can get a tool to code that properly, or you have to give full remote control to your MacBook to Apple to get into all of your software to like verify the parts. You really don't have control over how you would do that repair. So even though these new MacBooks actually do have some modularity in the parts and pieces, like you can take out 60 or 80 screws and you can get to different parts of the laptop. You can like replace USB-C ports. They're not soldered to the main board. There are a few things that are like pretty good for a MacBook, but ultimately you can't get to the RAM. You can't get to the SSD. Those are all hard connected to the new M1 and M2 processors. And anything that you change for the display or the sensor, or the lid or the battery will probably result in your MacBook not functioning properly or not functioning at all. And so even though the hardware is technically easier to replace than previous generations of MacBook, you can't really finish the repair. You can't really complete the reassembly of what this is looking like. So just like their phones, just like their tablets, Apple is increasingly ratcheting down harder on the options consumers have. And I think it is an extremely anti-consumer perspective. I think this is a tragic anti-competition move to have the company that dictates the repair window also be the same company that wants you to buy new products. Because Apple decides how long your MacBook is going to be serviceable. And Apple also has a vested interest in you buying more MacBooks. That should be a huge red flag to regulators. But again, Apple never receives that kind of regulatory scrutiny or that kind of pushback from journalists. And the few times they do, it gets all of this news, it gets all of this hype, it gets all of this attention. Like when Louis Rossman did that interview with the CBC. And they did a whole investigative report on Apple's repair business in Canada. And that got like millions of views. Like for a CBC investigative piece, got like 10 million views. 10 million views on hundreds of millions of iPhones sold every year. That's the minutiae of trying to properly educate consumers versus just absorbing Apple marketing. So this video from Hugh Jeffries put it out a little bit more than a day ago, a little more than 24 hours ago. Hugh Jeffries has 890,000 subscribers. I'm not bringing a ton of attention to a Hugh Jeffries video. I have like 45 people watching this stream right now. But this video has only gotten 190,000 views. How are we supposed to be good resources for family and friends if techies who follow things like build and tear down videos and repair videos, 890,000 people say they like Hugh Jeffries videos and only 190,000 have seen this one? How are we supposed to be properly educated to help our family and friends make better purchasing decisions if that's the disparity? Like four to one. The potential of LFA reviews. Luis Rossman is Louis Rossman's Puerto Rican cousin. Again, you'll pardon what little Latino comes out of my face. I just made him one of our own. It's just like I adopted Louis Rossman, and he'll come over for some empanadas or something like that. It's great. Yeah, Diago. I mean, how can we fight the morons that insult Lewis when he shows the issues with soldered SSDs? I mean, but again, it's like every time we bring up criticisms of a company like Apple, it comes like as a complete shock to people who are fans of the brand. And to me, it's like I'm getting a little tired. It's exhausting continuously telling them like, hey, I'm bringing this up because whatever Apple does now, in 2 to 3 years, it's going to hurt me. But right now, what Apple is doing now is hurting you. Oh, but people just like their products. I can't, you're not hearing me. Oh, but I mean, like, you know, if someone wants to buy a garbage iPhone SE, they can. But should they? And should we recommend it? And should that be the option? Oh, are you going to tell people to switch? And you're like, well, are they asking me for the better phone or are they asking me for the better iPhone? And that, I mean, like, it is so difficult breaking through the generational marketing of Apple, where I feel in the past, Apple did deserve some of their reputation for being late to market, but with a better polished consumer experience. Now, I think Apple is ratcheting marketing to misrepresent their products and misrepresent their competitors' products. And their efforts to say, oh, well, we really care about the environment and repairability, and you can recycle your old products at Apple, like, No, none of that's real. I really do not believe Apple has a vested interest in improving those situations or making any of that better for consumers. And in fact, whenever we see that, I think it's ratcheted again. So yeah, you turn in your used Apple product and you get a couple hundred bucks towards your next Apple product. And then if that's in good condition, because it's got to be in good condition to get the full dollar amount for your trade-in, Apple will clean it up and sell it for substantially more as a refurb. And as a refurb, you'll get like a 10% deal over buying brand new. So you don't even really save if you do Apple's refurb purchasing, and you don't really get a great trade-in if you send it directly to Apple. Like, that's so messed up. That is, again, it hurts the people most invested in the Apple ecosystem. And I still need to push back against it. Like, I'm not going to change their minds, but at least by continuing to sort of showcase this type of stuff and pointing to Hugh Jeffrey's videos and pointing to iFixit teardowns and talking about Lewis Rossman and Right to Repair, I can at least hopefully influence people outside the Apple ecosystem to not support business practices that will eventually hurt us the same way. But man, it's exhausting. Ugh, I just can't. And then it sucks. McCorkran, this is funny, though. Yeah, McCorkran's got two comments here. It's kind of bizarre how right-wing Rossman audience leans. Right to Repair is an act of government. And it's interesting watching his libertarian-leading audience kind of wrestle with that contradiction. So, Right to Repair as a philosophy should be openly supported by people who care about free market economics. And this is where, also, like, Rossman was on this live stream where someone was just like, but that's not what the market says, and if you just don't want to do what their company is doing, then you should just not buy their products. And they were talking about, like, tractors. And you're like, so who else should you buy from? Well, I mean, you just got to do your research. And like, so you obviously don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, but I mean, if like John Deere, if they're not letting you repair your tractor, then you should just buy another tractor. You should just throw away all of your John Deere tractors and just buy competitors' tractors that I guess exist because free market. As a philosophy, Right to Repair is very libertarian. But again, a lot of these libertarian ideals are just as utopian as my more socialist Star Trek ideas. Reality is somewhere in between Ayn Rand and Gene Roddenberry. And we just have to accept that there will always be this perpetual conflict between supplying everyone's needs and sort of having this worker idea of promoting from the bottom up, and then also this singular idea of the strapping inventor or business person leader who's going to sort of change a paradigm. Both of those are fantasy ideals. And the true meat and potatoes of the future of our economy is a pendulum swing. And sometimes we swing way too hard to the right, and sometimes we swing way too hard to the left. But right now, I feel we need to correct for the policies that have been in place since Reagan. I think we've swung too far to the right, and now we need to correct for that in an age of global warming with more collectivism policies, and eventually we'll probably get to a point where those left-leaning policies have pushed too far and we need to correct back and bring another sort of idea of balance to the table. But that's not where we are. It's not a both sides. Right now I feel we're weighted way too heavily to that side. In a market with actual competition, the philosophy of Right to Repair is very libertarian. If a company won't let you fix their products, you go buy from another company. That is the right to repair your product. But that's not the reality that libertarians are having to face right now. Right now, we're having open legislative conversations about whether or not people should be allowed to fix their products. And that's coming from government because of how companies at the top are lobbying are politicians. So if you're a libertarian, you should be more upset by a company gaming the government and spending speech dollars to influence their decisions, preventing you from fixing your products. That gets in the way of your free market. And now we need to course correct for that speech from major manufacturers. Because politicians hear speech from tractor companies way louder. That speech is way louder than us talking on social media or writing letters to our congressmen or ranting and railing on podcasts. None of my elected officials here in California are going to hear me say this. but they are going to listen to the campaign contributions coming from major manufacturers influencing their decisions on right to repair. So to Rossman's point, because I think Rossman actually does lean kind of heavy-handed business, you know, libertarian. He left New York. I think he did move away from New York, a more left-wing area of the country, and looking at other more tax-friendly areas of the country. And to be fair, his experiences in New York were totally justifiable why you'd want to leave. But this shouldn't be a lefty versus righty kind of conversation. Libertarians should be on board fixing our legislation surrounding right to repair. That to me is perfectly in keeping with the libertarian philosophy. And again, our right to repair should not be a gift granted to us from our government. It should be the way business is conducted. Like, it should just be accessible to people so that we can make the purchasing decision that we would want to make. Simon says, if no, you know, right wing to repair. Dave Burns, free market implies a market existing in the natural universe, like mass or energy. Simon says, if no, the free market is sentient and in no way mere speculation and guesswork. Guesswork. Man, this is funny. Oh, yeah. JGJ, I think the current market is becoming increasingly centralized. Yeah, they absolutely agree right there. See, companies don't have an incentive to compete. Companies don't actually like free market competition. That is an aspect of the consumer relationship with products and brands, which is why we should always fight for a healthy landscape of competition. It is the natural order of winners and losers in these markets to try and absorb competition or work out deals where competition doesn't happen, like in our broadband market, where you rarely have the ability to compete between different broadband suppliers. When you don't regulate competition, you end up with a non-free market where one company comes out as a victor and then no one else can compete or disrupt that service. Yeah, Marilyn, I agree with you there, but that's why I think we just need to prime ourselves. Sorry. Marilyn says, I wish we could find a middle point. It seems we always go from one extreme to the other. I agree with you. It would be really nice if we could find a better balance. But I think we can go into this with a healthier expectation if we expect that over 2 to 3 generations, it is likely that our policies will swing too far in either direction. From Reagan's union busting in the 80s, we now see sort of the generational impact of trickle-down economics and deregulation of business. Now we have an expectation. What happens when we let companies run amok with our money, with the financial industry, with the manufacturing industry, and we break up unions? So now we need to build back from that, walk us back from that edge. And maybe in 2 to 3 generations of policy that repairs, you know, the from that right-wing extreme, we'll probably end up with a left-wing extreme where unions are corrupt and we've got mafia-style, you know, issues. And we probably won't have learned from the history of or the experiences of the past. And then we'll probably need to walk it back again with some other sort of Thatcher-like figure 4 or 5 generations from now. But this whole experiment has been a failure for decades. And instead of acknowledging that and working to minimize how far that pendulum swings, we've just continued to push it more right. And that's bad. It's really playing out in a bad way for consumers. So, you know, now is the time to course correct and bring that pendulum swinging in the other direction. Yeah, Lewis did go to Texas. Thank you, Diago. I couldn't remember if he was still planning his move to Texas or if he actually had gone to Texas. Yeah, I'm way behind on this chat. Sorry, I'm trying to catch up. Yeah, McCorkran. It depends on the libertarian, though. There's no definition that I think is consistent. Knee-jerk contempt for regulations is not inherently libertarian. And that is, again, it's like there isn't one way to be a libertarian. So I feel like Rossman probably exhibits a lot of those more libertarian ideals, but he's working on the ground. He's boots on the ground. He is trying to live a business philosophy that makes sense to him in how he does. He runs his business and he interacts with his customers. He is not, I think, a libertarian idealist, if that makes sense. I think he's a libertarian realist. Man, we're getting real heady with these. I don't want to like put words into his mouth. I think you should just like, you know, watch his videos and stuff, because I think he makes very salient points about how business is conducted. Simon says, if no. Yeah, pretty much. Reaganomics, Thatcherinomics, trickle-down economics. Bush called it voodoo economics. You remember that really famous line from Ben Stein in Ferris Bueller's Day Off? Something, something economics, V-O-O, voodoo economics. And next week we'll call it wealth for all, but only at the top. So, who wants to talk about the Xiaomi? I love it. I love the tangents. Thank you so much for just letting me kind of vent on all of that. Short story, incredibly long. Let your family and friends know what they're in for when it comes to Apple products, because it just work can very quickly turn into buy a new one because yours is broken. This was a fresh edition. I knew that this announcement was coming up, but there's a new foldable coming out from Xiaomi. The Mix Fold 3 has been announced and has been detailed. Dave Burns, I do, Professor Juan. I love it. So this is I'm pulling this up courtesy of Mikhail over at GSM Arena. Mix Fold 3, we're getting the Snapdragon 8 Gen 2, and we're getting a pretty crazy stack of cameras. I will not be importing the Mix Fold 3. It looks fun. It looks really nice. I'm glad to see a lot of these technologies that have made Xiaomi so interesting are being brought to this foldable. But for imports, I need them cameras. Like it's almost always within arm's reach. Like this is my big Xiaomi expenditure of the year. This is my ridiculously outfitted Xiaomi 13 Ultra with the camera grip and the housing for lens filters and a proper 67 millimeter thread lens cap. And like I leave the house with this, like this, like it's a camera. I want it to be a camera. If I'm spending money on importing devices, I'm increasingly looking at the cameras. Like, I'm really hoping we do see a Vivo 100, you know, like, you know, from the X90 Pro to the X100, whatever it might be called. But Vivo has this out, Xiaomi has this out now, the Mix Fold 3. It's all of the things that we've been hearing in terms of foldable design, making it a little bit thinner. They are adding some really interesting cameras to the stack, to the back of this. A really cool new technology for stacking components vertically. This makes me a little anxious, though, because how all of these components are built into the back of the phone might feel a bit like the Pixel Fold. Heat dissipation is coming off of one concentrated section of the back of one panel, and you don't get the benefit of heat dissipation across all the surface area. It's a little bit more concentrated. My hypothesis would be this style of internal component management will likely produce poorer performance with the 8 Gen 2 as opposed to a more traditional slate phone like, you know, glass sandwich phone with an 8 Gen 2. I'd love to see someone actually test that, because I really don't care about an AN22 score. I really don't care about a Geekbench score. What I would want to see is, when you really start running this thing hard, you're shooting tons of 4K 60 video, or you're like editing photos in a really kind of heavy batch process or something like that, I believe you will see the impact of this style of manufacturing. This is incredibly cool that they could build all of the circuitry and stack all of these components into such a thin shell. Once we get over how cool the manufacturing is, I think that will have an impact on the performance of all of those parts being so condensed and so built into the back of the phone. Now, also improved this hinge assembly. It's a three major component hinge, but how did they describe it? Three element structure, 14 micro hinges that tuck in the main folding display for improved durability, and a carbon ceramic steel rotating mechanism. The kind of material science and the kind of engineering that is going into foldables right now is absolutely astounding. Like why there is such a price premium when you put these components into a portable communications device. This is a huge challenge that requires a ton of R&D. It's one of the reasons why like hinges on phones are going to be more expensive for a significant period of time. But we've got an 8-inch internal display, a 6.56-inch external display, both running E6 OLEDs, 120 hertz. The resolution seems low. Does this sound right? 1960 by 2160? That seems to me like the PPI would be a little low on something like that. Like, for all the years that I've played with Surface Duos and LG V60s and even the Z Fold and the Pixel Fold, not bad. That's not going to be a bad PPI, but it just seems a little squarish and a little low for the overall surface area. But max brightness of the outer display, 2,500 nits. I don't think you're going to have access to that with your little brightness slider, but in auto brightness, it should be pretty bright. I'll tell you, it is so infuriating on the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. This is supposed to be like one of the brightest screens they've ever made. It's a collaboration with TCL. I reached out to the folks at TCL and said, hey, I would love to do an interview with like an engineer and talk about what's new and different about the Xiaomi 13 Ultra display. It kind of never really got back to me. It doesn't work on command. I don't know if you remember the singing frog, Michigan J. Frog, from like old Warner Brothers cartoons. You know, hello, my baby. Hello, my darling. Whenever I try to shoot video of this display, like I'll be standing under a really shaded area and I'll put it out into bright daylight. I've got a camera on it and I'm trying to show like how bright it can crank. It never really does. Then I'll be in the middle of doing something else, like using the camera, and you'll see it pop. And it's suddenly like the clearest outdoor viewable display I've ever seen in my entire life. And it's so frustrating because I want to show that off. I want to demonstrate it in a video, but I can't. So when you see, you know, like, oh, the outer display on the Mix Fold 3 is going to be 2,500 nit brightness, it's going to be for a very short burst of time. It is an outdoor viewability mode that pops under a very specific set of circumstances. It is not something that you can just dial up yourself with the brightness slider. It's crazy good when it works, but it also doesn't work on command. Let me take a drink of water here.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by One More. Treat your ears. One More's mission is to bring innovation, design, and quality to all music lovers, young or old, frugal or spendy. Offering an incredible collection of earbuds at all tiers of the market, cabled or Bluetooth, neckband or true wireless. Fantastic sound quality, top-tier tuning, excellent noise reduction. I've personally been a fan for a couple years now. There's a whole collection of great audio options for you to shop at affordable prices. And for listeners of this podcast, I can also do you one better. If you shop at onemore.com, use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY10 at checkout. Once again, SOMEGADGETGUY10 with no spaces. You'll save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices.
You'd spend over $80 less on One More's dual driver ANC True Wireless compared to that other brand's Pro earbuds. You know who I'm talking about. One More brings style, premium audio quality, and cool tech features to the table at prices that won't hurt the wallet. You can check out these multiple award-winning audio solutions at onemore.com.
And remember to use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY10 at checkout to save some scratch.
Now, let's get on with the show. There we go. I tried to turn my mic back on, and instead I turned off the website. So here was the baseball super. Oppo lied about their 2500 nit display. Testing at notebook was quite lower. And I want to be careful about outright saying lie, because we let other companies dictate the terms of their testing. Like, we let laptop manufacturers say this is going to give you 8-hour battery life. But the testing of that is ratcheted to a very specific set of tasks. Like, if you watch video at 20% screen brightness and then write an email, you can do that for 8 hours on this laptop. So it's not a lie, but you have to understand how the testing is conducted. And when I try to force my Xiaomi 13 Ultra to show that hyper bright mode, I can't make it do it. But I can anecdotally say I was in direct California sunlight. It's 100 degrees outside. I'm trying to compose this shot. It's at a funky angle, and I'm trying to zoom in, and then the screen just pops. And it only does it for a short burst of time. This is just a you need to see what you're doing in this moment feature. And then it goes away. But it did it. And, you know, that's what I mean. I just have to tell you that story because I can't show it. And that's the thing that's challenging. Like, if you really put this into an indoor laboratory testing environment, it seems to know it doesn't need to do the maximum brightness on the screen. And I don't know how to conceptualize that. So I'm sorry. Anyway, getting back to this, this Mix Fold 3. We've got the cameras look really interesting. We've got a quad camera setup, 15 millimeter equivalent ultra wide, 23 millimeter equivalent main. There's a 2x pixel crop zoom mode from that main camera closing in on close to a 50 millimeter field of view. Then we've got a separate sensor for 75 and a separate sensor for the 5x. Now I'm hoping that this is actually a 3.2x zoom. Because if you remember from my videos, that is something Xiaomi has sort of misrepresented on the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. The 3.2x zoom sensor does not actually have a 3.2x zoom lens. And if you shoot raw, you see a wider field of view than if you shoot in the full auto mode. So I'll be curious to see if the Mix Fold 3 uses the medium telephoto from the Xiaomi 13 Pro, or if they're using a similar telephoto to the 13 Ultra. But because I see 10 megapixels on the 75 and the 115, I think it's going to be more like the Xiaomi 13 Pro. So we'll see. That is the more native field of view of that lens. The Xiaomi 13 Ultra uses different sensors and lens combinations. So I don't think it's going to be like the Ultra. Actually, I don't think you have enough space inside the phone to use the companion sensors from the 13 Ultra, because the companion sensors on the 13 Ultra are actually pretty beefy. So let me get this out of the way here. Snapdragon 8 Gen 2, up to 16 gigabytes of RAM and up to 1 terabyte of storage. We're also getting a little bit of a nudge to the battery. Now the Mix Fold 3 has a 4,800 milliamp hour battery. That's pretty decent for a foldable. And with the same 67 watt wired charging as the Mix Fold 2, but adding 50 watt wireless charging. So you can go wired wireless charging faster than most American phones can do cabled charging. So if you have a Samsung or an iPhone, the wireless charging on the Mix Fold 3 will be faster than the wired charging on a Galaxy Note 23 or an iPhone 14 Pro Max. And now the crazy thing, the absolutely stupid, stunning thing, as we look at this Xiaomi being sold in China, the equivalent price in US dollars for the base model Mix Fold 3 with 12 gigabytes of RAM and 256 gig of storage is the equivalent of $1,200 US. That is crazy pricing on a foldable. So if you buy this in China, you will start at roughly the equivalent of $1,240. If you climb all the way up to the 16 gig RAM, 1 terabyte of storage model, $1,500. I imported my Xiaomi 13 Ultra. This is the 1 terabyte of storage model of the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. I would usually fight that, but I, you know, where I get cranky about phones that don't have memory card expansion and stuff. But I genuinely have been using this as like one of my primary B-roll cameras, and sometimes even my A-roll camera, depending on where I'm shooting. This thing has been a monster. I'm really glad I chose the 1 terabyte model, because I've been putting hundreds of gigs of 4K video recording on this phone already. So, when I imported the Xiaomi 13 Ultra, it was just a little bit less expensive, less than 10% less expensive than the Chinese local price for the 1 terabyte model of the Mix Fold 3. When you're selling on your home turf, you can sell at a more aggressive and a more competitive price. I have to believe that if the Mix Fold 3 gets an international release, it will be more expensive for dealing with other regulatory, local regulations on radios and performance and power. Also for whatever tax for importing and exporting devices might be applied. I bet you it will be more expensive internationally. To know that it's selling for $1,500 in China is ridiculous. So I just want to do something here real quick. This podcast is not sponsored by Giztop, but I got my Xiaomi 13 Ultra at Giztop. They were the first ones to carry the 1 terabyte version. And so I just want to see if I were to go, so like, let's say gold. No, I don't really like the gold. I should do this on screen. So first of all, the starter price is $1,599 for importing. So this is already quite a bit more expensive than the local Chinese prices. Cup of Cash is already saying it starts at $1,600 on Giztop, and if we go up to 512, it's $1,800. They don't have an option currently, or at least not through my browser, for the 1 terabyte, but Cup of Cash is saying people are selling the 1 terabyte variant for $2,000. But that's actually not terrible considering the price of like a 256 gig Pixel Fold, right? So quadrupling the storage on a phone with 4 cameras, yeah, around $2,000. Makes sense. Simon says, Hypno, just imagine how good Sudoku would be on that big phone. It's so great. Let me tell you, I'm out here playing solitaire. You got plenty of room to play Klondike. Whew. So yeah, it's pretty great. From Raj, Google and Samsung, and I would add Apple to this list. Google, Samsung, and Apple aren't investing anything in charging tech in-house. I also don't understand why licensing 65-watt power delivery is so hard for them. I think a part of the reason is right there in that word. They'd have to license a more expensive charging technology, and then those components would actually have to live up to that licensed charge speed. And that's just additional costs for them. If consumers are still buying Galaxy phones with fake 45-watt charging, why would Samsung spend more? Right? If Apple can say, like, hey, you can charge your iPhone a little bit faster if you hook it up to an iPad charger, Why would they actually improve the internal tech on the iPhone and make it better? In fact, I think Apple looks at that and says, like, we hope you'll do it, because that style of charging an iPhone battery faster will wear out the iPhone battery quicker. It's what's going on in these other, like, Super VOOC and Xiaomi fast charging and all these other technologies are things like split battery cells, better power management from the charging brick. So, like, Super VOOC needs a proprietary brick. It's not power delivery. And that is how you get some of these advances in charging speed without your phone just getting nuclear hot while you're trying to charge it. Diago, where is the air horn? Is there? Oh, J-Man150. Hey, look at that. Gifted a tier one sub to Diago. There you go. Here's your air horn, Diago. Although that's for J-Man. J-Man150 hooked you up with a tier one sub. So he gets the air horn. In fact, I should have said, Diago, don't listen. So that air horn. Thank you again, both of you, for tuning in and for supporting production on this. So here's the deal. One of the other reasons why I am not bullish on importing or buying this Mix Fold 3, the cameras look like they're going to be solid. I've had very good experiences with the cameras on the Pixel Fold. I felt like shutter lag was a problem on Samsung still for the Z Fold 4 and the Z Fold 5, but like they're good photography platforms. It's just, man, when you start using like those 1-inch sensors and you start really trying to push the limits on what these other phones can do, I mean, especially like a Sony Xperia, if you're not going 1-inch, like there are some radical new technologies that are really fun for video and photography. I just like, that's where I'm kind of choosing to spend my money. But the other thing that's kind of it's kind of slowing me down is I just don't like this form factor. I don't like it on the Samsung Z Fold, and I don't love it here either, or the idea of it, because I really haven't played much with the Mix Folds, the Xiaomi foldables, where you get this like skinny outer display and you get this sort of vertical hinge that cuts through the middle, because a lot of the way that I would like to multitask is I would want to turn the whole tablet 90 degrees. But then even though it's minimized, there is still a trench, there's still a crease in your folding plastic screen. I think Xiaomi has done a better job of minimizing that than Samsung has, but it's still warping a plastic display. And so when that cuts through the middle of both of your apps, it makes me kind of cranky. When I open up my Pixel and I have two apps side by side, the crease is exactly where the gap would have been on my Surface Duo. And I genuinely prefer having the crease in between two apps when multitasking. So I got like, you know, my Photos app, and then I can pull up a web browser. You just kind of long press on that and you pull it over. See, you got two panels side by side. That is an almost Surface Duo like gesture to immediately go into split screen multitasking. And the crease is not cutting through both of my apps. The crease is separating my apps. And in fact, we even have, like, I know people didn't love it on phones, but there is even just a little bit more of an animated strip between the apps. There's a little bit more of a handle so that you can see where the separation is between the two apps that you've got side by side. I do not like the vertical hinge on the Honor, the Z Fold, or now here on the Mix Fold 3, precisely because a lot of the stuff that I do, I like to split screen. And if I split screen vertically, you get these ridiculously strippy versions of the apps. So I'd rather have the more landscape view, but then I have light bending right through the middle of each app. That is a very minor critical nitpick for people who might be buying these things. But to me, that stands out even more when we're talking about products that are going to cost north of $1,500 for us to get our hands on. If I'm going to buy one of these things and I step up my storage and I'm talking about an $1,800 purchase, how light is refracted through the middle of my apps matters a lot more at $1,800 than it might have at $1,000. So I have to step back from that and say, hey, this has always been problematic for me. I've always been bothered by this, And if you're not bothered by it, Godspeed. Go buy what you like. But I can't spend $1,800 when the hinge is in the wrong orientation for how I would use this. And I think that's fair for other people out there to kind of know, like, a minor visual discrepancy like that matters a lot more when you're closing in on $2,000. I feel like that is fair criticism, even if it maybe doesn't make your purchasing decision or purchasing recommendation. Got a comment here from Raj. How are the Pixel Fold cameras, Juan? So I don't think I'm going to do a full camera deep dive, but I am going to be doing a camera review because the experience is so point and shoot simple. It is the same kind of delicious Pixel, take it out of pocket, snap the shot, put it back in pocket that I've always appreciated from other Pixel devices. Photo quality is very similar to what you would have on a Pixel 5a or Pixel 6a from that main sensor. But the fun stuff is where you can get into some better low light telephoto shots. And I find myself doing stuff on the Pixel Fold that I also used to do a lot on the Pixel 7 Pro. And it's really fun stuff. Like I'm just kind of sitting down and maybe my kid's doing something cute, just like on the other side of the room. And I can very surreptitiously like snatch a little photo of it indoors in dim lighting. And Pixels are so good for that. Like that candid moment, that indoor moment, it's a more functional telephoto experience for me than some of the others. Like on a Galaxy S23 or S23 Plus, I don't find you get that same kind of quality. And especially when you ratchet down like HDR processing and stuff, I find Pixels typically outperform for that kind of use. So that's where the Pixel Fold has actually kind of come in handy, right? You can kind of aim out the shot and it's a very small and discreet. You can kind of bend up part of the screen and stabilize it, brace it, snap that little photo, kind of close it back down again. It's all very subtle. It's all very discreet. But if you're into candid moments, like I like to shoot those kinds of family moments, the Pixel Fold has been better than I was expecting it to be. I think since I know what I'm doing with these phones, I think my Xiaomi is better. But it's also better at like significantly more depth than what I'm carrying around with the Pixel Fold. I think all these people are like, oh, you know, foldables. It's like you've got two phones sandwiched side by side. And I'm over here like, yeah, but I want a grip and a lens housing. And this still kind of fits in my cargo shorts. But if I don't want to carry all that, I can at least do that. But that's still real chunky. That is almost as chunky just on its own. So the camera housing, you can't see this. This is like the worst podcasting ever. This is in a case, and this is in a case. And the two cases together, I think the Pixel Fold is maybe just a touch thinner than the full case and camera housing on the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. That's remarkable. That's intense. I mean, like, I don't think we really do a good job of properly expressing, like, what these things feel like. Oh, it feels really nice in the hand. Tells you nothing. But the actual depth on this thing, just on its own, or actually in the case, but just on the camera module without all the extra stuff that I add to it, that's foldable territory. So our foldables are impressively engineered. See, Dave Burns, you can say it's a Pixel A series camera, but I feel like that's actually better for most people. I hate making that, you know, but average consumers who drag their knuckles on the ground and breathe through their mouths, they don't know how things work. There is a style of photography that is very selfie, Instagram-y in that moment. And if you want the best version of that, I think you gotta go Pixel. The second you start considering your frame and composing your frame, I think you get a better experience with cameras that give you more control. But that it's like the iPhone camera is trying to do something like that. The Samsung auto mode is trying to do something like that. But if you're on a Samsung, if you want the best image quality for composing a shot, and then you can edit a little on the back end, you want to avoid the auto modes and go directly into your expert RAW modes. And I think you get incredible quality to work with in that mode. Ditto. Like, I'm mostly shooting full auto in manual mode on my Xiaomi. Like, I'm not afraid of editing some DNG files, and sometimes that stacked RAW is really, really nice. But if I want the best, like, point and shoot, click, a moment's happening and I just need to capture that moment, I do believe. I think the Pixel stands head and shoulders above most of the competition there. I have a feel for different cameras where I kind of appreciate what does what better. And I can replicate some of that on my Xiaomi, but it's never quite as seamless and it never sticks focus quite the same way. And those little nuances and the simplicity of the Pixel camera experience, the Pixel camera UI, I think it adds up to a really pleasing shot in that moment. If I plan the shot, I'm typically fighting the Pixel camera. But if I'm just trying to capture the moment, then I think the Pixel does live up to some of those claims where it's aiding you in abbreviating the image capture. Yeah, Goat V8, I agree with you. I wouldn't even mind a bit more of a squished down landscape screen. I really think the slightly more landscape view is the better orientation for the hinge. My eyes cannot look away from lights reflecting off of the bounce in a crease. I'm way too hyper distracted. Squirrel! Like, I can't let that go. I'm in the middle of watching a movie and it's cut through the middle of the screen in its widest orientation, and it is so disruptive to watching that movie. I do not like it. And in the same way that, like, you'd have a vertical strip going through that movie, it is minimized to just that vertical strip. It's not running the entire length of your film frame. It's just piercing through the middle of the film frame. It's not great. I can't look away from that light disruption on the Pixel, but it's a lot smaller a disruption than what you get on, like, the Mix Fold 3, the Z Fold, and the Honor. So, yeah. So, Raj, here's what I think is kind of funny. So, Raj says, the voice of point-and-shoot people is vastly underrepresented in tech commentary, where most reviewers are content creators. I feel the point-and-shoot style is vastly overrepresented. So look at the scores on something like DxO Mark. DxO only tests their cameras in, like, full auto mode. And they regularly misrepresent things like equivalent focal lengths, because all they're doing is shooting full auto in an average consumer kind of way and then racking up scores based on that totally full auto experience. Or you look at, like, content creators who shoot on cinema-grade cameras, but then the most that they use their phones for are taking some selfies. And now let's do a camera comparison with these terribly composed selfie-style shots. And instead of saying, like, hey, there's a reason why you'd want to step up to a 13 Ultra, you don't really get more benefit out of better camera hardware for this point-and-shoot style. But so many content creators default to this. Well, but I mean, like, most people or average consumers, they're not looking to push the boundaries of, like, what artistic expression can look like from a mobile device, or what editorial or journalistic content can look like from a phone or a tablet. So I feel it's the opposite. I feel like we've heavily overweighted the auto mode conversation, and we usually ignore all of the more advanced features because people just want to see the good colors. Let's do a side by side. I shot both photos side by side, which is terrible to compose. It means one phone got your attention and you composed the shot for that phone, and the other phone you just pushed the shutter button because it was sort of in the same place at the same time. You didn't compose the same shot for both. You tried to set up different angles and different positions for two cameras. If you were a camera reviewer, you would be laughed out of the room for trying to do a demonstration side by side like that. I put two DSLRs side by side and I pushed the shutter on each. Yeah, you have two different photos. You didn't take the same photo of the same subject. You took two completely different compositions. So you're not helping this conversation. You're just showing us which camera you like better. Because that's probably the camera you composed for, not the other one. So sorry, to me, it's funny how we kind of position these commentaries, because what we care about influences our opinion of the content that we get back. So if you go, I don't want you to click on it because it's going to give them traffic, but I was very disappointed where DxO was comparing the Xiaomi 13 Ultra against, I think it was the Huawei P60. And in comparing against the 13, and in comparing the 13 Ultra against the P60, they lined up the telephoto shots at the focal lengths of the P60. But that means they were almost always crop zooming from the 13 Ultra. So they were comparing native resolution, native focal lengths from the P60 to crop zooms of the 13 Ultra. But not explaining. So they just said, hey, if we take this out to 90 millimeters, that's what your photos are going to look like. Well, at 90 millimeters, you're cropping from the medium telephoto to a pretty extreme degree. So you're losing a lot of resolution and it's a crop zoom. But the 90 millimeters is a native focal length for the P60. But they don't explain any of that to their readers. They just put two photos side by side and see, we showed you the data. We showed you the output. And now you can see for yourselves how one is better than the other. But they haven't educated their readers to understand equivalent focal lengths on all of these different lenses. So to me, they've done a massive disservice to the potential education of their readers and their viewers. Why would you pick those two focal lengths to showcase the strengths and weaknesses of the Xiaomi 13 Ultra camera? I can't think of a good reason why you would crop zoom against a Huawei, unless for some reason you wanted the 13 Ultra to look like a poorer performer than it really was. And they don't even really get into the differences for things because they don't shoot manual modes. They missed the real controversy with the 13 Ultra, where you've got to crop from the medium telephoto to simulate 75 millimeters, because it's not a 75 millimeter equivalent lens on the Xiaomi 13 Ultra. But because they were looking for some type of comparison point to make the 13 Ultra look less good, they missed a real opportunity to inform consumers about an issue with the 13 Ultra camera. That, to me, is the massive problem we've got with boiling everything down to most people, average consumer styles of reviews. I'm listening to, like, camera podcasts, and it's crazy to me how applicable so much of their commentary is to smartphones now. They're talking about interchangeable lens systems and shooting this kind of content and working with this type of image processing software and what you can create with it and how you do walkthroughs. And maybe you're more of like a photojournalist, or maybe you're like, you work in architecture or something like that. And you're like, you know what? So much of what you're describing could be done by phones now, and like at reasonably comparable quality to standalone mirrorless cameras. It's pretty rare now that I'm out and about and I don't have my Panasonic, my G9, and I feel like I totally missed an opportunity to get a good shot from like one of my phones. There's one instance on the Discord. I shared a photo of a praying mantis that I took over the weekend, and it was genuinely one of the first times in months where I couldn't wedge a phone into a space to get a good photo of a bug, and I had to go and get a camera with a longer lens and a variable tilt display to be able to properly zoom in on this bug. And that might have been the first shot in almost a year where I felt like, no, I need to get a mirrorless to get this job done right. Because otherwise, the phone has actually been a much more accessible and discreet tool to achieve that style of photography. So that was all very long-winded and rambling. Bionic Scoop, thank you. I don't even know what you're replying to, but I just kind of feel like, yeah, we're probably simpatico in that degree. I mean, like, and Scoop is exactly the kind of guy you should be following for these types of photography-focused conversations, because, like, he is pulling off stuff with Micro Four Thirds sensors that blows my mind. Like, I own cameras that are roughly comparable to what Scoop is shooting on right now in terms of capabilities and sensor size, and he's pulling off shots that I'm not quite entirely sure I understand how he got that shot. It's like he's pulling off some voodoo with stuff that I'm very well familiar with. But yeah, Onscon had to bounce a little while ago. I feel it's about that time that we should start wrapping all this stuff up here too. Tech Lover Mama's just saying hey to everybody, giving us a wave. But I guess the main takeaway from that whole last part of the conversation, and I'm genuinely happy to see that Xiaomi is iterating on their foldable and bringing some of this camera tech that I'm a big fan of to these now more delicately hinged foldable devices. But it's also like we're still in a conversation about picking the right tool for the right job, and I still feel we need to be careful positioning these solutions to consumers. I don't want to scare away a potential foldable fan by being too critical over some of what I feel are the drawbacks of a foldable. But at the same time, I don't think we've gotten good guidance from the manufacturers to properly showcase where a foldable could really contribute to someone's lifestyle. And I feel like we're in this middle information vacuum. I think we've got plenty of people who are ready to just break a foldable on day one to show you they're more fragile, and that doesn't tell you anything about really using it. And then I think we've got some people who are probably more like me. We've been way too exceedingly careful in taking our foldables out into nature to test them and to use them. I need to get over some of that because I'm supposed to be one of the people that demonstrates. And I've been very anxious about like Z Folds and Pixel Folds and even my Duos, really like digging them into the dirt. Sometimes I'm just going to have to take that hit and see what it really looks like when I do that stuff with these more fragile phones. But to that same token, I also want to be the guy who's like telling people, and I want to be a resource for right tool for the right job. And if you're telling me you care about camera stuff, then I say you got to ignore a hinge for another year. If you're telling me you care about camera stuff and you've not played with a Vivo, if you've not played with an Oppo Find N6, if you've not played with a Xiaomi 13 Pro or 13 Ultra, if you've not played with a Sony Xperia 1 Mark V, you're missing out on some really, really exciting camera tech. You're missing out on phones that are nipping at the heels of Micro Four Thirds interchangeable lens systems. Like, it's getting real exciting. But you have to care about a conversation that leans more into content creation and composition and light and exposure and photography. And if that's not your bag, then don't spend that kind of money on an expensive camera phone because you're not going to get the benefit out of it. So I just think this is really precious right now. I don't want to scare people away from crazy camera phones and folding phones and these purpose-built devices, but I also don't want to overrepresent or misrepresent what they can really do and where they should really be used. And I'm stuck. Like, I get real anxious about, I'll take this out and I'll shoot this photo of it. But if I shoot a photo out on a technical hike with a folding phone, am I misrepresenting the durability of a folding phone? Because I don't want to leave the audience off with that impression. So it takes a lot to kind of work up. I got to take these little baby steps. So it's cool stuff. It's really fun. I'm having a lot of fun. But it also makes me crazy anxious. Aditya Anil, maybe the real camera phones were the friends we made along the way. Chances are really good, and Aditya, I think, would probably attest to this too, because he's an Xperia user. Chances are pretty good that you have a camera in your pocket right now that you could push farther. So even with me out here, you know, proselytizing about like 1-inch camera sensors and ultra phones and Pro Plus phones. This is the last year's, you know, mega awesome Pro Plus phone. You could probably push your own camera farther. You could probably learn a lot about photography and light and composition and editing before you go to spend $1,400 on a new phone. And all it takes from you is the curiosity to go out and shoot more photos. That's it. I mean, after you've bought the phone, the rest of that is free education. And you can just go do that. You don't need to wait for me, and you don't need to read a score on DxO. You can just do it. And it's pretty great. It's a lot of fun. I very much recommend it. So, Dave Burns. No fun. Phones are boring now. Nothing said so. Nothing said that phones are boring. And I guess that's how a lot of people feel, because they don't try doing anything new with their phones. So I feel that's more on them than the amazing phones that I've got sitting out in front of me. You know what I just realized is we got to the end of all this, and I completely spaced that one of the topics that I put into the title of this was talking about a drone. And I have to end this podcast, but this is a drone. And if you tune in to my channel, youtube.com/JuanBagnell or somegadgetguy.com, you will see me talk about this adorable little drone, the Hover Air Camera X1. And I apologize because I finally got sort of some of the conversation to talk about this is ready to go. And I completely forgot to mention the drone. I'm going to have to edit like the title of this podcast because I really didn't talk about it. Stay tuned. the perfect holiday gift, DTNL. So, folks, I want you to have an amazing week. Oh, Dave Burns, your e-bike videos are going to get super cool. I've got tracking shots and zoom-ins and pans. I showed some of that. I actually took it out for a bike ride. And it's a pretty capable little pocket drone there for shooting video. So, folks, I want you to have an amazing week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And as always, I want you to take care of yourselves so that you can continue taking care of others. We're wrapping up the summer, and I think we're still in for some really challenging times, getting back to school, getting into the holidays, and beyond just, you know, whether or not we're asking after our family and friends. I just think a lot of folks are going to need that little bit of extra help, you know. Check in with the people you care about. Keep those relationships sort of maintained and healthy, and just sort of be on the look. Be on guard. I think this year feels like it's going to be tough for a lot of people. And these transitions can be challenging as we move through different parts of the year. So, keep an eye out for all the other streamers. Tomorrow is Gadget Goddess, Kimmy, over on her channel. I'm sure they're going to have a lot to say. Excuse me, man, I'm wrapping this up with all the coffee burps again. I'm sure Kimmy is going to have a lot to say about the Mix Fold 3. She's sort of the queen of foldables, and I would highly recommend checking out her channel for good lifestyle conversations on folding phones. We've got Easy, Eric, Easy Computer Solutions. We've got, I don't know what's going on with Thursdays. If Ike is going to be streaming again or if he's going to be taking a little more time off. But TK and I will probably be streaming on Thursday. Friday will probably be LaShawn. We've got El Jefe. And we've got Nomad Tech Project and El Jefe stream over the weekend. There is tech content going up every day that's so much fun to interact with. So definitely give everyone a shout there. Tell them I sent you. I'll catch you back here next week. Take care. I love y'all. I'll catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.